The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. And this week we'll be reading from the edition dated June 3rd, 2011. And our first item from the main story section in The Week magazine this week is entitled The GOP Search for a Presidential Candidate. What happened? The field of frontrunners for the Republican presidential nomination came into sharper focus this week as Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels announced he would not seek the presidency. Daniels was the third Republican in 8 days to announce that he would not run, leaving three former governors as the leading contenders for the nomination. Mitt Romney of Massachusetts, Tim Pawlenty of Minnesota, and John Huntsman of Utah. The others to drop out were former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, a favorite of Christian conservatives, and real estate magnate Donald Trump, who briefly led in the polls. The waiting is over, said former Republican National Committee Chairman Ed Gillespie. Things are going to accelerate pretty quickly now. But many Republican Party officials and conservative activists expressed concern over the remaining candidates' lack of star quality. The party's most popular figures, including former Florida Governor Jeb Bush and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, have repeatedly insisted they will not run. Sarah Palin's popularity has plunged, and insiders doubt she'll enter the race. Some conservatives were hopeful that another candidate would jump into the race, while others predicted that the current field would grow in stature now that they have the country's attention. Everybody is waiting for Superman, said Fred V. Malik, a Republican advisor, and soon they will learn that Superman is already in the race. Now here's what the editorial said about all of this. It's not just Republican insiders holding out for a hero, said The Economist. Neither Tea Party activists nor the Christian right yet have an anointed candidate to call their own. Their current favorite, Minnesota Representative Michelle Bachmann, is too fire-breathing to win mainstream support, while the presidential candidates of former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich are already dead in the water. That leaves a trio of establishment candidates with no true conservative credentials, said Investor's Business Daily. Mitt Romney introduced a health care mandate in Massachusetts that many consider Obamacare light. Pawlenty has supported cap-and-trade environmental policies in his state. And Huntsman was appointed ambassador to China by Obama himself. No wonder some are looking beyond the field for a champion in this most critical of elections. Now here's what the columnist said. The GOP's best candidates are all sitting on the sidelines, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com, as Republicans realize they'll have to choose between Romney, a candidate by default in the tradition of John McCain and Bob Dole, and the mild-mannered Pawlenty. They're feeling emotions ranging from disappointment to panic. The party is desperate for surprises and dark horses. Patience, our prayers will be answered, said William Kristol in the Weekly Standard. The first primaries are 8 months away, which leaves plenty of time for dynamic figures like Texas Governor Rick Perry or Wisconsin Representative Paul Ryan to jump into the race. Keep praying, said John Dickerson in Slate.com. Each passing day makes it more difficult to imagine a just-add-water insta-candidate, appearing to mount a credible challenge to an incumbent president. The longer challengers wait to join the race, the more spectacular their arrivals must be, and the less time they have to raise funds and build momentum. Perhaps Republicans ought to stop waiting for magic to arrive and start looking for it in the candidates already running. When they do, they might just like what they find, said Carl M. Cannon in RealClearPolitics.com. As former governors, Romney, Huntsman, and Pawlenty all have solid experience with balancing budgets and winning elections. Four of the six previous presidents were ex-governors, and one of them, Bill Clinton, rose from a field widely characterized as unimpressive to unseat an incumbent president in 1992. Critics say the remaining GOP candidates lack charisma. But look at Jimmy Carter in 1975 or George W. Bush in 1999. It takes time to be perceived as presidential. This election will mostly be a referendum on Obama anyway, said Steve Kornacki in Salon.com. If the economy continues to improve, then it really doesn't matter whom the Republicans nominate, they'll lose. If unemployment remains high, the recovery stalls, and the public is restless enough to dump the incumbent, generic will be enough for the Republicans to win. Our next item from the main story section is Obama's European adventure. President Obama this week traveled to Europe to strengthen old alliances and build consensus on how to handle issues of joint concern, including negotiating with the Afghan Taliban and ousting Libyan despot Muammar al-Qaddafi. His triumphant one-day visit to Ireland was followed by royal pageantry and a state dinner at the Queen's London residence, Buckingham Palace. But after the pomp came politics. Presenting a united front, Obama and Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron said in a joint appearance that the West's best response to the democratic movement sweeping the Middle East was support and encouragement, not military intervention. The Arab Spring was also high on the agenda at this week's G8 summit in France, where Obama and other world leaders were to create an aid plan for Tunisia and Egypt, loosely modeled on the U.S. post-war Marshall Plan for Europe. The trip was long overdue, said Kerry Butoff Brown in Politico.com. Although Obama remains popular with Europeans, his shine has worn off with their political leaders, who often feel the self-declared Pacific president cares more about Asia's emerging economies than about his allies across the Atlantic. Let's hope Obama's tour, which includes meetings in Poland with Central European leaders, will convince his hosts that he hasn't forgotten about them. Nor should he, said Timothy Garton Ash in the London Guardian. America and Europe need each other in the effort to keep the Arab Spring alive. Only the U.S. has sufficient clout to prevent the Egyptian military from strangling their country's new democracy at birth. But that fledgling democracy won't thrive without access to European markets, education, and support. By working together, Europe and America could ensure that the Arab Spring becomes a lasting freedom summer for the whole of the Islamic world. Has Obama thrown off the lukewarm approach he's had toward Britain? Asked Niall Gardner in the London Telegraph. He did say this week in London that the special relationship between the U.S. and Britain remains the greatest catalyst for global action. But in the past, he's treated Britain as an afterthought, and now he'll have to back up his words with some action. And our next item, a setback for the Ryan plan and a stunning upset with national implications. Democrat Kathy Hochul beat Republican Jane Corwin this week in a special congressional election that centered on their party's stark differences over Medicare reform. Hochul, a moderate Democrat who relentlessly criticized Corwin's support for Wisconsin Republican Paul Ryan's plan to privatize Medicare, captured 47% of the vote. Corwin drew 43%, and independent Jack Davis, who ran on the Tea Party ticket, took 9%. Corwin had been considered a favorite to maintain the GOP's iron grip on the upstate district between Buffalo and Rochester, which the party controlled for decades. Republican leaders John Boehner and Eric Cantor flew in to support Corwin, but her stiff, unfocused campaign and support for Ryan's plan turned off many voters. The privatization of Medicare scares me, said Pat Gillick, one of many Republicans who crossed party lines to vote for Hochul. Let's not read too much into one election, said Henry Olson in NationalReview.com. A breakdown of the vote shows that Davis played the spoiler, drawing blue-collar votes away from the Republicans. And Corwin never convincingly dispelled working-class voters' unfounded fears of a secret Republican agenda to eviscerate middle-class entitlements to fund tax cuts for the wealthy. The GOP needs candidates who can fight the war over the future of Medicare fiercely and intelligently. The fact that Corwin wasn't up to the task doesn't mean that the others won't be. "Sorry, but Republicans can't really pin the blame for this result on Davis or on Corwin," said Nate Silver in NewYorkTimes.com. "Polls gave strong circumstantial evidence that voters didn't like Ryan's plan to replace direct medical payments with subsidies for private insurance. No single special election has much predictive power. But Ryan-style Medicare reform doesn't look like a winning issue." "That's putting it mildly," said E.J. Dion in the Washington Post. "This is simply not a district a Republican should have lost, not when Democrats got only 26% of the vote there in 2010. But Hochul shrewdly picked up the one issue, Medicare, that could peel conservatives' votes away from the Republicans. This is a big setback for Paul Ryan's budget and a warning for Republican incumbents everywhere." And now let's turn to the controversy of the week. Obama's peace proposal, an affront to Israel? In a bold attempt to jumpstart the stalled Middle East peace process, President Obama displayed uncommon grit last week. Said the Christian Science Monitor in an editorial, Obama made a major address on the Arab Spring, warning Israel that the growing hunger for freedom in the region makes the creation of a separate Palestinian state more urgent than ever. Negotiations, he said, must start with borders established before the 1967 Six-Day War, when Israel occupied the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, but can allow for swaps of small parcels of land. In speeches and in an icy face-to-face meeting at the White House, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu reacted with fury, asserting that Israel would never retreat to indefensible 1967 borders and branding Obama's plan a radical departure from past U.S. policy. "As a supporter of Israel, I find Netanyahu's disrespectful hissy fit puzzling and alarming," said Jeffrey Goldberg in TheAtlantic.com. Inciting the 1967 borders as a basis for negotiations, Obama was simply using the same framework that Bill Clinton, Ehud Barak, and Yasser Arafat talked about at Camp David 12 years ago. So why did Bibi go out of his way to alienate the president? "It's Obama who picked this fight," said Brett Stevens in the WallStreetJournal.com. Showing a mastery of the concept of chutzpah, he called for Israel to concede to the 1967 borders before the Palestinians recognize Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state. "This deeply troubling policy shift comes at the worst possible time," said the New York Post. Palestinian leader Mohammed Abbas recently forged a unity agreement with the bloodstained terrorists of Hamas, who are committed to Israel's destruction. And last week, Abbas confirmed plans to seek UN recognition of a Palestinian state this September, a diplomatic nightmare for Israel. With his reckless talk of 1967 borders, Obama has supported Abbas's argument to the UN that Israel is now engaged in an illegal occupation. "Obama understands something that Netanyahu does not," said Roger Cohen in the New York Times. "The status quo no longer favors Israel's long-term interests. As Obama noted in his speech, occupation is humiliation, and humiliation has given rise to the popular uprisings in Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya. As the hunger for dignity and self-governance grows throughout the Arab world, Israel will not be able to keep the Palestinians safely walled up forever. I sympathize with Bibi's fears of Israel's enemies," said Richard Cohen in the Washington Post. "But events have made his belligerent, black-and-white worldview dangerously obsolete. At current birth rates, Arabs will soon outnumber Jews inside Israel's borders. Abbas is the most reasonable Palestinian Israel Palestinian leader Israel could ever face across the bargaining table. The world now sides with the Palestinians. It's time to make a deal. For now, the stalemate will continue, said Jackson Deal, also in the Post. Netanyahu followed up his hostile meeting with Obama by trying to go around the president, arguing for his hardline position in a speech to Congress that drew repeated standing ovations. If this feud continues, the results could be catastrophic, said Thomas Friedman in the New York Times. Peaceful Palestinian demonstrations at Israel's borders are bound to grow in size and number. A belligerent response by Netanyahu would end any chance for peace and leave Israel known throughout the world as the Jewish apartheid state. If that happens, the tensions between the U.S. and Israel displayed in Washington last week will seem quaint by comparison. And now it's time to turn to the popular feature in the Week magazine called Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4. And it was a good week this week for stunts after the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention posted an emergency guide for how to respond to an attack by flesh-eating zombies. The page, posted to draw traffic to the CDC website, became so popular that the server went down. It was a good week for having a bark worse than your bite after a tiny yapping teacup poodle confronted a 200-pound black bear that had wandered into his owner's Washington State yard. The frightened bear climbed up a tree, jumped into a neighbor's yard, and fled. And it was a good week for noodling, the popular southern tradition of catching catfish by hand after the Texas legislature reversed a long-standing ban on the practice. I personally don't noodle, but I would defend to the death your right to do so, said State Senator Bob Dool. And it was a bad week for a balanced diet after Don Gorski of Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, ate his 25,000th McDonald's Big Mac. I plan on eating Big Macs until I die, said Gorski, who eats two for lunch every single day. His cholesterol was recently tested at a very low 156. It was a bad week for Stephen McCormick, a New Zealand trucker whose skin was pierced by the fitting of a compressed air hose. As air was forced into his body at 100 pounds per square inch, McCormick said, "I was blowing up like a football." He was rescued by co-workers. And it was a bad week for taking your work home with you after NASCAR superstar Kyle Busch was arrested in North Carolina for allegedly driving his new Lexus sports car at 128 miles per hour in a 45-mile-per-hour zone. "I got carried away," said an apologetic Bush. And now let's turn to the People's section from the Week magazine for June 3rd, 2011. Our first item here is entitled Magic, 20 Years Later. Magic Johnson knows he's a lucky man, said Allison Samuels in the DailyBeast.com. 20 years after the basketball great announced he'd contracted HIV, he's alive and well. Back in 1991, when he startled the world by disclosing that he'd been infected, the disease was usually fatal. "Hands down, the first 5 years were the most difficult for me," he says. "There were those moments when thoughts came like, what if I don't make it? But they were fleeting. I couldn't let myself stay there for long." 18 months before it was approved for the general public, Johnson was one of the first patients to try a new powerful cocktail of antiretroviral medications. The cocktail worked, suppressing the virus's replication so completely that he never developed AIDS. Now 51 years old, he rises every morning at 4 a.m. and jogs 5 miles to his offices at Magic Johnson Enterprises, a multi-million dollar company that specializes in urban redevelopment. He takes nothing for granted. My son Andre, his wife, and a baby girl were over to the house on Easter, he says. It was such a special moment to be able to hold and play with my granddaughter and see my son actually become this great husband and father. I had to stop myself from tearing up because who knew? Who really knew? The next item from the People's section is the Cartoon Newsman. You may not know Jimmy Lay, but you've probably seen his work, said Andrew Goldman in the New York Times Magazine. Lay, who is 63 years old, a Hong Kong media mogul on par with Rupert Murdoch in Asia, is the brains behind the surreal animated reenactments of news events that have taken YouTube by storm. What we get on TV is always the last bit of image, he says. What we don't see, the pilot flying the plane drunk and what happened in the cabin. If somebody jumped off a roof, we only see the body, even though the guy might have gone to Macau, lost a lot of money in a casino, was chased by a loan shark. Lay's company churns out the reenactments quickly. His breakthrough video of the Tiger Woods SUV crash was released just hours after the incident. Though he strives for accuracy, he doesn't always hit the mark. There's a problem with faces, he admits. Often they have a distinctly Asian cast. Critics say his depictions go too far, such as the recent one in which Arnold Schwarzenegger throws cats at Maria Shriver and participates in an orgy. But Lay makes no apology for his methods. The core of the news is still right, he says. Just because nobody has ever tried something doesn't mean that it's crazy. And our next item, how Smart moved on. Elizabeth Smart is not looking back, said Melinda Rogers in the Salt Lake City Tribune. It's been 8 years since Smart was found in the city of Sandy, Utah, after having been abducted from her home at age 14 by Brian David Mitchell and Wanda Barzee. Held prisoner for 9 months, she was repeatedly raped by Mitchell, who claimed to be the voice of God on earth. This week, Smart faced her captor for the first time since she escaped when Mitchell was sentenced for his crimes. The most wonderful thing about it is that it will finally be over, she said beforehand. A dedicated Mormon who recently returned from an 18-month mission to France, she's entering her final year at Brigham Young University and is contemplating going to law school. She's also received a $50,000 grant to set up a foundation to teach kids how to resist abductions. Right now, I'm just sort of staying open and not closing any doors. I want to go where I can do the most good and make the biggest difference. Time will tell. She feels a debt of gratitude. So many people did so much for me and my family. I could never say thank you enough. You're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine for this week. Thanks for joining me today. Now let's turn to the briefing, which this week, the briefing is entitled The Ophthalmologist Dictator. Until his troops fired on protesters, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad was considered a moderate. What happened? How did Assad gain power? Through old-fashioned dynastic succession. He became president in 2000 after the death of his father, Hafez al-Assad, a tyrant who had ruled Syria for 30 years. The family's oldest son, Basil, was supposed to follow his father as ruler, while Assad was sent to London to continue his training as an ophthalmologist. But Basil died in 1994 in a car accident, and Assad was quickly summoned home from his studies in Great Britain and shunted into a military academy. When the senior Assad died, the parliament quickly lowered the minimum age for candidates from 40 to 34. Bashar al-Assad's age at the time. He was elected unopposed. The regime claimed he received 97% of the vote. Is he more moderate than his father was? It would be hard not to be. Hafez was a brutal dictator who occupied neighboring Lebanon for decades and funded Hezbollah extremists. He had thousands of political opponents murdered, and he was responsible for the single deadliest attack by any Arab government on its own people, surpassing Saddam Hussein's 1988 massacre of Kurds in Halabja. In 1982, he obliterated the Syrian town of Hama to crush a revolt, killing at least 20,000 people and possibly as many as 40,000, all civilians. The younger Assad has committed no atrocity on that scale, but his government has continued all along to imprison and torture political opponents and has responded to the recent Arab Spring protests by killing hundreds. On his watch, Syrian intelligence was accused of assassinating former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri in 2005, after which Assad was forced under U.S. pressure to pull Syrian troops out of Lebanon. Why did we misread him? Well, it was partly wishful thinking. After all, he didn't fight his way to the top, and he wasn't groomed to be a dictator. Assad speaks fluent English and decent French and makes a generally mild impression. His glamorous wife, Asma, was born to Syrian parents in Britain. A former investment banker, she's been profiled in Vogue magazine. And Assad certainly has modernized Syria, turning Damascus from a dreary socialist city into a vibrant Arab capital, with chic shops and trendy internet cafes. During the decade of his rule, the country has privatized many sluggish state-run industries. Foreign investment has flowed in, and cell phones and satellite TV have become ubiquitous. How does he keep his grip? By controlling the military, the Assad family belongs to the Alawite minority, a fringe Shiite Muslim sect, which is one reason why Syria, unlike most Arab countries, is so closely allied with Shiite Iran. Most Syrians, however, are Sunni Muslims. When Assad's father seized power in 1970, he placed loyal Alawites in key positions throughout the military, secret police, and the government. The Alawite elite now dominates the entire security apparatus. Unlike in Egypt and Tunisia, where the professional military class exerted its independence and refused to crack down on peaceful protesters, in Syria, the military can't really be seen as separate from the regime. How has Assad justified his crackdown? He has blamed armed terrorist groups for the violence. Foreign-inspired groups, the regime says, have killed civilians as well as members of the security forces. In reality, opposition leaders and human rights activists say Assad's forces have been firing on unarmed protesters. During the 2 months of a pro-democracy demonstrations, Assad's loyalists have killed more than 900 civilians, but not all of Assad's forces are joining in. Over the past month, some 200 members of Assad's Ba'ath party have defected, including several lawmakers. Assad has intensified his promises for reform, but his troops' assault on demonstrators continues. Why has so little been done to stop him? Lack of leverage and fear of consequences. President Obama recently demanded that Assad either get out of the way or lead a transition to greater freedom. But the sanctions he leveled against the Syrian regime aren't much of a spur for a country that gets no U.S. aid. And some U.S. allies are not at all sure that Syria without Assad would be better than with him. Former U.S. Mideast negotiator Aaron David Miller wrote recently in Foreign Policy, Turkey, which shares a longer border and a restive Kurdish minority with Syria, is leery of instability there. So is Israel, which got a glimpse of chaos last month when Assad allowed Palestinians in Syria to storm Israeli border defenses at the Golan Heights. The government in Jerusalem wants to work with a devil they know, says Moshe Ma'oz of Hebrew University, and this Bashar, they know him. And the footnote to the briefing this week, Why Syria's Christians Prefer Assad. One group not wholeheartedly embracing the anti-Assad protests is Syrian Christians, who make up at least 10% of the population. Under the Assads, Christians have been allowed religious freedom, and they have prospered to the point that they now make up much of the professional middle class. Our feeling is, if the regime falls, the Salafis and the Muslim Brotherhood will seize power, and that is bad news for us, said Archbishop Moore Cyril Amfrem Karim of the Syriac Orthodox Church. History has proven to us that Christians have always had more secure lives, better treatment by people who may be looked on as dictators, like Saddam Hussein. After Saddam fell, Iraqi Christians were targeted by extremist groups, and fully half of the Christian population fled, many to Syria. Syria has been a beacon of freedom and security for Christians in the largely hostile Arab world, said Patrick Sukheyo of the international Christian group Barnabas Fund. If they are now forced to leave the country, where will they go? And now from the Week magazine, let's turn to the best columns of the U.S. Our first column today is entitled, Perp Walks Are an Abuse of Justice. Andrew Cohen, TheAtlantic.com, is the writer. The French have spouted a lot of sexist, conspiratorial nonsense about the arrest of Dominique Strauss-Kahn, said Andrew Cohen. But they're right about one thing. Forcing handcuffed criminal defendants to make a publicized perp walk is barbaric and totally at odds with the presumption of innocence. Cops and prosecutors last week paraded Strauss-Kahn, then the head of the International Monetary Fund, before a battery of photographers after he was accused of sexually assaulting a hotel chambermaid in the glare of flashbulbs. The alleged perpetrator, with his hands cuffed behind his back, looked guilty and ashamed. To the surprise of Americans, the French were outraged. Isn't that how we treat all high-profile defendants? Indeed it is, but sometimes it takes an outsider to see clearly the truth. The truth is that the perp walk is one of the most cynical conspiracies in all of modern-day criminal justice. The media gets its photos of the accused, and law enforcement gets to cement an indelible impression of guilt into the minds of potential jurors. Fairness and justice be damned. This is no way to run a court system. The next column this week is The Economy Deserves a Jolt of Optimism, written by Robert J. Samuelson in The Washington Post. If Americans could all get beyond stubborn gloom, says Robert J. Samuelson, we'd see that the economy really is getting healthy again. Despite continued high unemployment and expensive gas prices, all signs point to a recovery that's gathering steam. Companies are hiring, consumers are shopping, exports are booming. People are paying down debt and getting back to spending within their means. Americans have 140 million fewer credit cards than we did before the crisis. The savings rate has gone from 1% in 2005 to between 5 and 6% now. The U.S. is exporting 22% more food and 18% more industrial goods than it was a year ago, which will lead to more hiring. Even in the depressed housing market, the worst may be past as pent-up demand grows. In fact, the greatest barrier to recovery now could be psychology. The Great Recession taught us to be wary of bubbles and foolish optimism. But now the recovery needs more spending and more hiring to feed on itself, and the enemy is foolish pessimism. And our third column from the best columns in the week magazine from the U.S. this week was entitled The Demise of the Public Library by Charles Simic, the New York Review of Books. The public library is becoming an endangered species, said Charles Simic. Throughout the country, states and cities facing budget crises are closing libraries or curtailing their hours. Denver, for example, plans to close half of its 23 branches, while Los Angeles will cut hours and staff and close on Sundays. Libraries in several smaller cities are closing altogether. Some politicians claim the Internet has made libraries obsolete, and with politicians in both parties pledging never to raise taxes, libraries rank low on the priority list. But I find this disheartening. Millions of poor people, including many who've lost jobs in the recent recession, depend on libraries for access to the Internet, as well as to the books, periodicals, and staff they can find there. There's nothing quite like a library with its stack of hidden treasures, and people of every kind reading in silence and peace, exploring the collective wisdom of mankind. Nothing so effectively conveys to school children a sense of awe about books and reading. In the richest nation on earth, the sight of a shut-down library is a terrible thing. So is the thought that someday soon, libraries will be considered obsolete. Now from the Week magazine, let us turn to the last word this week. The article is entitled, Rock and Roll Survivor. Steven Tyler has battled back from addiction and illness, says Brian Hyatt, and is relishing his latest comeback. For a moment, Steven Tyler almost runs out of words. He's standing too close to the edge of a Laurel Canyon cliff, exulting in the panorama of Los Angeles at his feet. The city's sprawl giving way to white-capped mountains on the horizon. I'm really lucky right now, he says. I'm on top of the world. I'm Hollywood's little expletive sweetheart. 4 months ago, Aerosmith's frontman moved from Boston to Los Angeles for his life-changing gig as a judge on American Idol. He rented a house in this storied neighborhood with its beguiling blend of rock history and natural beauty, an echo of the New Hampshire woods where he spent his childhood, summers climbing trees and skinning raccoons. Early most mornings, Tyler hikes to this peak to spar with a trainer. When he hits the top, he puts on boxing gloves and tries to hit as hard as he possibly can. I've been knocked down too many times by the world, Tyler says, so it just feels good spiritually. I'm still standing. It's been a wild journey. His band hasn't released an album of original songs in a decade. Their last real hit, Jaded, was in 2001. In the meantime, Tyler faced one knockout blow after another. He discovered he had hepatitis C in 2002. Then he was incorrectly diagnosed with a brain tumor. He had surgery for a voice-threatening throat problem, and he struggled with a foot ailment that could have kept him off stage forever. He got addicted to drugs again, prescription ones mostly. He went through one detox and two rehab stints. He fell off a stage in front of thousands of fans in Sturgis, South Dakota, and his bandmates threatened to fire him. His wife of 17 years left him. His mom died. I was a mess, Tyler says. I was clinically depressed. But the last rehab seems to have turned things around. Tyler's found a serious new girlfriend, 35-year-old Erin Brady, a long-legged, wicked-tongued brunette bombshell. He's got Idol, and hey, hitting bottom just helps him savor this moment here at the top of the world. If you're sober for 20 years, you lose the rewards of first getting sober, he says. Early last year, at the height of a months-long feud with his bandmates, an angry and frustrated Tyler began looking for a backup plan. I told my managers, screw them, get me a job. He ended up as a judge on American Idol, a show he had barely watched. On the show, he's far from a Simon Cowell hard-ass. There wasn't anything about that I didn't like, he recently told one contestant after a performance. And as he might be the first to tell you, America loves him in this new role. He's moved to tears by the contestant's sob stories and performances alike. My feelings, man, I'm beyond touchy-feely. That's why I say I'm 60% woman. He's verbally inventive and avuncular with the young female contestants without creeping out the nation. He seems to maintain a respectful peace with Jennifer Lopez and has become actual pals with Randy Jackson. Tyler landed the job by playing piano in a producer's office and telling stories of his pre-rock and roll childhood. Tyler's father was a Juilliard-trained musician, and some of his earliest memories are of lying beneath his dad's piano as a 3-year-old listening to him play classical music. We'd seen probably 40 people for the job, says Fox executive Mike Darnell, and actually I saw Roger Daltrey. He came in and he was the complete reverse of Stephen. Very formal. His hair was cut. He looked like a regular guy. He had lost all that sort of rock and roll charm. But Stephen was unbelievably charming. He was not snobby about music. He told me about his dad being a classical musician. He told me that he sometimes gets emotional about songs and cries when he hears them. I knew right away we had gold. All I did, and I thank the Lord above, I took a risk, says Tyler. I think if you were to really peek under the hood of what got Aerosmith back again for our second life in the 80s, you'd find out that it's exactly this. It's the willingness to take a risk. And his TV gig is just a part of a big year for Brand Tyler. His autobiography, Does the Noise in My Head Bother You, came out in May, as did his first solo single of his career. But for all his personal success, he's endlessly preoccupied with the band he helped form 41 years ago, especially his fraught relationship with lead guitarist Joe Perry. My other self, my demon brother, Tyler calls him in his book. After the 70s, excess derailed Tyler and Perry, the toxic twins, as they were known. Tyler put together 12 years of sobriety, leading Aerosmith to heights that exceeded their original run. But around 2002, he began to slip. He blames it a little fuzzily on the hepatitis diagnosis and the pain of his foot condition. Painkillers and Xanax were his drugs of choice, and as his foot pain got worse circa 2007, he took to snorting huge Xanax pills he called Zanzibars. I was in a cast for 3 months, and they gave me a ton of pain meds, he says. Being a drug addict and an alcoholic, I was off and running. By the third month of recovery, he was snorting OxyContin, too. Then one night, he did coke again. The next day I woke up and said, Holy Mother of God, what am I doing? So he went off to rehab again, and he was soon clean, but in unbearable pain, wondering how he could ever tour. In the summer of 2008, Tyler flew home to be with his ailing elderly mother. She was his first fan. She drove him to gigs. She didn't laugh when he told her, as an unknown 19-year-old, that she was going to have to buy a new house soon to get away from his crazed fans. She died in July 2008, and Tyler couldn't take it. Just a few months after rehab, he began using drugs again. The day after we met on the cliff, Tyler is in his American Idol trailer on a studio lot in West Hollywood, with a stylist and a makeup artist working simultaneously on his hair and skin. They're detailing him like he's a vintage sports car. Early Stevie Wonder is playing from an iPod, and a live feed of the Idol rehearsals is on muted TV. Tyler is about to do his first show with a live audience, but he's still busy talking about Aerosmith. Did I take this job to show the band? Yeah. Agitated as usual, he says, I will be my own hostage. The band can't throw me out. Truth is, this wasn't even the first outside job Tyler considered. You're looking at a guy who played with Led Zeppelin, he says, with boyish pride. In September 2008, Tyler flew to London and walked into a rehearsal room with Jimmy Page, John Paul Jones, and Jason Bonham, where they were there waiting for Tyler. Tyler was the right guy for the job, but he turned it down. I called Jimmy up 2 weeks after I left and said, you're a classic band, and so is mine, and I just can't do that to my guys, and I can't do it to Robert. In any case, he went to the Betty Ford Center for 3 months at the end of 2009, and this time he got really clean. Meanwhile, the band members asked their lawyer to look into the possibility of firing Tyler and made a point of telling the press that they were seeking out new singers. He still did makeup dates with Aerosmith, with Hate in My Eyes, which to him ended up feeling like some of their best shows ever. I've been a little foolish, but I'm glad I was foolish, because it kept us an old-fashioned band, 5 members who all get equal pay for an unbelievably long time, Tyler says. Tyler's assistant and his leather-clad personal stylist, a French guy who looks like a hipster Dracula, are nudging him to get ready. Hold on, guys, I only have one thing to do, and that's to step into a pair of pants, okay? Step into a pair of pants, baby. Eventually, he excuses himself. Flanked by an SUV-sized bodyguard, he heads off to the hangar-like studio, where he'll shoot idle for the next 3 months and find himself in the middle of his latest comeback. Back in Laurel Canyon, Tyler is doing the full Tyler, yodeling and scat singing into the hills to test the echo, singing bits of Beatles, Birds, and Aerosmith songs in full voice and showing off a remarkably proficient bird call. "You must admit," he says, "through all the frills and all, I'm one of the most interesting guys you ever met." Almost every car that passes slows down, and the drivers roll down their windows to tell Tyler how much they love him on Idol. I ask him if he's worried that he might become too beloved, too safe. If there's a danger of being seen as the sort of caricature Ozzy Osbourne turned into for a while in the wake of the Osbournes TV show. As he thinks about it, another car approaches and actually stops in the middle of the road. The couple gets out, and they ask for a picture. Tyler poses graciously and continues his thought as they drive away. "Whoever I am or think I am, whoever you think I am, maybe I'm not that guy," he says. Doctors at one rehab where he was working out his codependent relationships with the rest of the band, not any addiction, made the mistake of sticking him in a sexual concerns group. "I'm in the wrong place," he said. "I want to be between three women, not chained to a urinal at the Ramrod Room." But he's convinced that his many liaisons, including the on-tour hookups that ended his most recent marriage, were merely the result of opportunities not available to other men. New Age author Marion Williamson, a friend who helped him break his drug and alcohol dependencies, once told him, "What do they expect? You've been a rock star for 20 years. I had a choice not to," says Tyler, "if I had screwed up. But when you're tempted, if you're a bear and you're not supposed to eat honey, but everywhere you go there's bees, you're going to dip your tongue in." Priapic as he may be, Tyler is 63 years old, though he hates when journalists point that out. He doesn't think much about mortality. "I'm going to get up to heaven, and the gate's going to open, and God's going to go, 'You know what? I threw Beelzebub out while we were listening to one of your songs.'" But he does imagine rather frequently just how he might die. "I'm very vivid with my imagination, getting stabbed and pulling the arrow out, or I can picture my gut spewed, or more often than not, lately, it's in a bed with my children around me as my mom passed away, hoping they don't give me too much drugs. Where I'm like this," he sticks his tongue out spastically. Then he gets serious for a moment and continues, "I think I've been so lucky in my life that I'll probably die in my sleep. Thank you, Lord Jesus." And that particular article about Steven Tyler was published in Rolling Stone magazine, copyrighted 2011, and read, of course, with permission from Rolling Stone. And you're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine right here on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Now we'll turn to the Talking Points section. Our first article, Schwarzenegger and DSK, Men, Power, and Sexual Aggression. "What makes powerful men behave so badly?" asked Nancy Gibbs in Time magazine. That's the question that pundits, social scientists, and lots of women are asking after two world-famous men were brought low last week by reckless sexual aggression. Dominic Strauss-Kahn, then the head of the International Monetary Fund and a likely French presidential candidate, was charged in New York City with the sexual assault of a hotel maid. His lawyer claims he consented to oral sex. On the other side of the country, former California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger was admitting to having fathered a love child 13 years ago with his housekeeper. In this ostensibly enlightened age, when men and women live and work as peers, why do so many famous and powerful men continue to treat women like prey? The conventional wisdom, said Scott Lehigh in the Boston Globe, is that libido and ego share the same psychological bandwidth. The same excess of self-regard that leads men to believe they should be running the world also deludes them into thinking they're exempt from rules governing lesser mortals' sexual conduct. But this theory doesn't explain why priapic poles are so indiscreet and so reckless. Look at Bill Clinton, carrying on with an awestruck young intern bound to blab about it, or former New York Governor Eliot Spitzer, wiring himself $10,000 to spend on prostitutes. If these men love their power so much, why do they so foolishly risk throwing it all away? Because it's in their nature, said psychologist Frank Farley in the Los Angeles Times, men who actively seek power and public attention are by definition people who crave variety, novelty, intensity, and uncertainty. They're easily bored by ordinary life and relish risks the rest of us would find intolerable. Their risk-taking and need for constant affirmation often compel such men to step outside the confining conventions of monogamy. Indeed, they often see extramarital sex in the riskiest situations imaginable, as if asking to be found out. John F. Kennedy entertained hookers in the White House. John Edwards impregnated his mistress while running for president. Senator John Ensign carried on an affair with his chief of staff's wife. Strauss-Kahn does not belong in this discussion, said Juliet Williams in the Washington Post. Yes, he appears to be a serial philanderer like Schwarzenegger and dozens of other disgraced politicians. But DSK now stands accused of a brutal sexual assault. Rape is not a scandal, said Amanda Marcotte in the London Guardian Online. Rape is a violent crime, and there's no excuse for those who fail to distinguish between actual assault and caddish but consensual behavior. The two cases are different in dozens of ways, said Gregory Rodriguez in the Los Angeles Times, but there's one unsettling similarity. Both cases involve a rich, powerful white man taking advantage of a domestic servant from a racial minority. No one has alleged that Schwarzenegger's Latina housekeeper didn't consent to their sexual relationship, but consent is always a murky concept when a boss presses himself on an employee, particularly when the boss is as rich and powerful as Schwarzenegger. His affair, like Strauss-Kahn's alleged assault, echoes a time when white men used their darker-skinned slaves and servants as sexual playthings. When it comes to sex, power, and race, not everything has changed. Perhaps not, said Leslie Bennett in the DailyBeast.com, but women have. Even a few decades ago, a hotel chambermaid who complained of being assaulted by a wealthy white politician would have been told to shut up or lose her job. This time the maid stuck by her story, and the cops pulled the rich white man off his flight, put him in handcuffs, and paraded him on a perp walk. Schwarzenegger's case is, of course, less egregious, but his wife will likely divorce him, and he's the subject of widespread scorn and ridicule. John Edwards' affair cost him his life, marriage, and future prospects, and then Governor Mark Sanford admitted to an affair with his wife, who chose to divorce him and write a tell-all book rather than become another long-suffering political wife. Finally, look at the price Tiger Woods paid for his philandering. His gorgeous young wife walked out with $110 million, and after Woods lost his good guy image, his confidence and golf game collapsed. What used to be dismissed as incorrigible male misbehavior, it seems, now carries serious consequences. Boys may still be boys, but women are not interested in the doormat role anymore. And our next major item here from Talking Points, the rapture. Should we be laughing? I do not understand why nothing has happened. That was how Robert Fitzpatrick reacted to the failure of the world to end on May 21st, said Samuel Goldsmith in the New York Daily News. The New Yorker had spent $140,000 publicizing a prophecy made by Christian evangelist preacher Harold Camping that the end of days would occur at 6 p.m. on Saturday, May 21st. Obviously, I haven't understood it correctly because we're still here, Fitzpatrick told reporters in Times Square, as the world inconceivably kept on turning. Camping himself, who has spent almost 20 years predicting the rapture on his family radio network, claimed to be flabbergasted that he and his flock had not risen bodily into heaven, said Will Kane in the San Francisco Chronicle. Meanwhile, his dejected believers were left with a dilemma. How do you live in a world you thought would no longer exist? All right, we can all stop laughing now, said Tiffany Stanley in the NewRepublic.com. It's easy to indulge in the cheap mocking of camping's sad group of apocalyptic believers, but these people bet their entire lives that he was right. Most quit their jobs, and one young couple with a toddler and a baby on the way spent their life savings. The tragic characters taken in by camping's cult deserve our pity, not smug superiority and cheap laughs. "Oh, lighten up," said Andrew Sullivan in the DailyBeast.com. "These Book of Revelation crackpots thought that the dead would rise from their graves and that true believers would literally float away to heaven as the vast majority of the human race died in agony. Such nutballism begs to be made fun of." "Besides, camping's followers will probably be just fine," said Vaughn Bell on Slate.com. "Doomsday cults and other religious fanatics have evidence-proof belief systems that prove resilient to challenge from outsiders. History shows that the prophecy will be reworked and the followers will carry on, often feeling more spiritually enriched. They have passed a crucial test of their faith." Camping's acolytes, in fact, already have a revised revelation, said Elizabeth Tennity in the Washington Post. The evangelist announced on his radio show this week that Saturday's rapture was a spiritual rather than physical event, and that the real end of the world would come on October 21st, 2011. You've been warned. And now, in the last few minutes of our program today, let's take a look at some short items. So-called inactivists have gathered enough signatures to get a referendum banning male circumcision on the ballot in San Francisco in November. The law would make no exceptions for religious reasons. Books selected for Oprah's 1 million book club sold an average of one million copies each. I'm sure they'll miss Oprah Winfrey's show. The helicopter that crashed during the Navy SEALs operation to kill Osama bin Laden, defense and aviation experts say, appears to have been a heavily modified secret aircraft designed to elude radar and heat-seeking missiles and make less noise. Pakistan recovered part of the downed chopper. Indian mothers have aborted close to 8 million female fetuses over the past decade out of a desire to have boys instead. For every 1,000 boys under the age of 7 in India, there are now only 914 girls. Hollywood will release a record 27 sequels this year. The total encompasses the highest number of Part 4 films ever, including new versions of Mission Impossible and The Pirates of the Caribbean. There will also be 5 fifth sequels, including one to The X-Men, 2 seventh sequels, including one to Planet of the Apes, and the 8th Harry Potter movie. And now, as we conclude for today, let's take a look in our poll watch for this week, June 3rd. Almost all American parents today, 94%, say they expect their children to attend college. But 57% say colleges do not provide good value for the tuitions they charge. Of those who attended college, 86% say it was a good investment for them personally. And 38% of Americans believe Israel and the Arab nations will someday live in peace. 60%, however, doubt a peace deal will ever be reached, and that's according to a poll by the Gallup organization. Well, we have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen to us next time. I hope you really enjoyed this. I'm George Douglas, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And the content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast right after the broadcast. So long until next time.